Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The investigation of the death of DJ Henry is just one big story competing for headline space this week. So joining me now to talk about more of the week's noteworthy news, including updates on the final days of the campaign season, is Renee Loth, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
And also with us again is Ken Cooper, an independent journalist who's written for papers including The Globe and The Washington Post. Welcome back to Radio Boston to you too, Ken.
Good to be here, Sasha.
And listeners, if you want to talk about some of the week's news, give us a call. Election news, political news, any other news. We want to know if you're ready for the election to be over, if you think Governor Deval Patrick will be reelected. Anything you want to talk about, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Renee and Ken, we just heard that piece that Bianca Vasquez-Tonez did and then Monica Brady-Myrov's update. And Ken, you had just said a bit earlier that this... Actually, you were talking about a different case. Let's talk about that one later. But I wonder if either of you want to weigh in on DJ Henry in terms of whether the DOJ is likely to step in or... I mean, this is very much in New York. This was a New York shooting. It's a New York investigation. It's just very... It's very personal for Boston still because we lost a Bostonian.
Well, I think the Justice Department has probably pretty strict standards about when they get involved in these kinds of cases. And I don't know exactly what they are. But often, when there are police shootings, there are disputes of this nature. So... they may review it, and they may or they may not.
And actually, Ken, it was this case that you said reminded you of something that had happened in, was it New York?
It was in New York City. I believe it was in Queens. A young man by the name of Sean Bell was out with his buddies the night before his wedding, and they were partying. And the upshot was that he was shot by police officers in his vehicles. And a central part of the police defense was the allegation that Sean Bell had used his vehicle as a weapon to threaten and strike officers on the scene, which sounds very familiar to the police account in this case.
I did think it was interesting, as Monica mentioned, that at least in Massachusetts, basically we have a guideline that one police department does not investigate its own case, whereas in New York it looks like that rule doesn't apply. So things are a lot messy in this case because of that reason.
Yeah, I think something similar is happening now in the case that we've just been reading a lot about this week regarding the young man who was an escapee from a DYS facility who was arrested at Roxbury Community College and whose arrest was videotaped by a young woman who was watching it through kind of a window area. That, too, is going to be investigated by an independent outside the district attorney's office, and I think that's a good thing.
Let's talk about that. As you said, this was a 16-year-old. He was a juvenile offender. The arrest was caught on videotape by bystanders, which is largely why this has gotten so much attention. It was posted to YouTube, predictably getting many, many hits. In the video, it looks like one of the plainclothes policemen is hitting the boy, is kneeing the boy, and there are several other police officers on the ground on top of him. Let's listen briefly to a sound from that video.
I understand, yo. How old is he? Probably like 18 years old. Got 9 cops on him. Like, come on now. People's adrenaline is pumping, but damn.
He wasn't even really all that out of order for them.
Now, Renee, as you were saying before we came on the air, just today, one of the officers involved, Michael McManus, was put on paid administrative duty, basically meaning desk work. And this is relevant because you can explain, Renee, McManus was involved in another case that got a lot of attention.
Well, my understanding is that, yeah, this same officer was involved in the case of, and I'm forgetting the young man's first name, but his name was Woodman.
That's right.
Who was killed in a celebration of the Red Sox?
That's right.
Victory.
It was a victory.
In Kenmore
David
Square.
Woodman, I think, was his name.
Yeah, and he was found to have. I guess that raised some questions in Commissioner Davis's mind. Although I should say that all of the officers in that Woodman case were eventually exonerated.
That's right. It was a Celtics victory.
Correct.
Exactly.
Celebration in outside of Kenmore Square. I think this gentleman's been put on desk duty while this investigation continues. And it is very disturbing to see the video, you know. But I also have to say that, you know, it's not Rodney King. You know, it appears that as soon as they got handcuffs on the young man, they all stood up and moved back from him. And that's what they were struggling with, trying to get a handcuff on him when he was, you know, he had half a cuff and they're pretty heavy metal implements, and I think they felt there was some danger there.
Another interesting piece of this, I'm not sure if you, if the two of you have been able to watch this video all the way to the end, but there is a bystander filming on a cell phone, I believe. At one point, a police officer turns to the woman and says, "You can't do that." And she doesn't stop her, and she continues to film, but he says, "You can't do that." And that has raised some questions about, well, what can you and can't you film? Massachusetts is a two-party state, which means you can't audio tape someone without their consent. You can't do a concealed audio tape. But can you speak to this at all, the issue of whether there are issues, or Renee, you look like you want to jump in.
Well, I actually looked into this because I thought this was interesting. I remember as a reporter being told when you go to work for a newspaper in Massachusetts, you cannot audio tape somebody without getting the permission first. And it's different in each state. But I did check into this, and it's completely legal to videotape, for a citizen to videotape an incident out in public, you know, in a public sort of way. It wasn't a hidden tape. So, I mean, the police officer didn't grab her cell phone or try to stop her from taping the incident. That might have been a problem for that officer. But, you know, it was just sort of like, let's keep calm here, and, you know, you shouldn't be taping this. And I think, you know, somebody might speak to him a little sternly, but I don't think necessarily that's going to be a big issue for him.
Ken Cooper, do you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I think, you know, if the police officer actually stopped her from doing what she was doing, it would have been a clear violation of the First Amendment. He acted on behalf of the government to stop her, a private citizen, from doing that. That said, I think the two larger issues here are not only whether excessive force was used or whether the use of force complied with department policy, but secondly, whether the department policy is a reasonable statement of when force can be used or cannot be used. And I'm not sure the second question is going to be looked at, and it needs to be. And this might be another reason why we need an independent police board in this town.
Let's talk about Chuck Turner. As I mentioned before, a guilty verdict came in today. This was just within about the past hour, I believe. This was a federal corruption trial. I believe the charges were perjury and bribery. And the jury found Turner guilty of all of those charges. Did the two of you expect this outcome?
Initially, I thought there was enough sort of murkiness around this case that Turner might have been able to, you know, get away with just one charge or not the other. But I think after he decided to take the stand in his own defense, you know, he sealed his own fate because he was not persuasive on the stand. And I happen to know that his lawyer begged him not to testify on his own behalf. So I think, you know, that may be a decision he made that he's just going to have to live with the consequences.
Originally, the charge was that he had taken a $1,000 bribe. In closing arguments yesterday, I believe, that was when his lawyer had said, actually, it was just $200. So, Ken, do you have any take on this?
Well, I think, you know, Turner testifying smacks a little bit of martyrdom and a will to martyrdom that it's kind of tough to watch. I must say, in terms of the prosecution, I've always been a little troubled that there's no direct evidence of a quid pro quo. In fact, Turner scheduled a hearing before he met this guy. I mean, certainly he shouldn't have accepted whatever he accepted if it was more than $50, and that's a crime. But I am troubled by the nature of the prosecution not being able to show a clear quid pro quo. I'll give you this, and you do this for me.
Let's also talk about the governor's race. So just one weekend left, as you heard us talk about earlier, basically it looks like a statistical tie between Deval Patrick and Charlie Baker. What do you think can happen this weekend, if anything, to widen that gap? Or does it just all come down to who turns out to vote and who doesn't turn out to vote?
Renee, well, you know, I've been saying during this whole campaign that we should be wary of the polls and not giving too much credence to the polls. But now the polls are not telling us anything because they show everything as a statistical dead heat. So now maybe I should believe the polls. But I do think that it comes down to something on each side. I mean, for Patrick, it is the question of whether he does indeed have the much vaunted ground operation that he says he does, of volunteers who will go out and turn out his vote. And for Baker, I think it is whether the rising tide of Republican successes that's happening all over the nation crashes onto the shores here in Massachusetts as well. I mean, sometimes Massachusetts goes its own way, but this in Massachusetts, this campaign has been nationalized. You know, there's a lot of national money. There's a lot of national attention. It's not just a Massachusetts electorate or Massachusetts. Well, it's a Massachusetts electorate. It's not just a Massachusetts vote, though. And I think that helps Baker.
Ken Cooper?
Well, I think I think the polls are a little on clickers. There was a poll earlier this week that gave Patrick a 7-point lead. But if it is a statistical dead heat, it probably bodes well for Charlie Baker, because we're talking about an incumbent who, if it's narrowed, it's narrowing near the end, which is exactly when the challenger wants to peak. I agree with Renee on mechanics versus enthusiasm. The other morning, during the morning rush hour near my house, Patrick, people were doing a standout, and there were a lot of them, and they were in the prime spots. But I noticed nobody was giving them a honk of approval. Whereas in January, in that same intersection, Martha Coakley was barely represented, and Scott Brown's people had all the prime spots and were getting lots of honks. So organization, but it's a clear lack
That's
of enthusiasm.
Ken's scientific study right there.
Suburbanites and city dwellers on the way to work, okay, where this intersection is.
So what about the Bill Keating, Jeff Perry race in the 10th Congressional District to replace the retiring Bill Delahunt? Either of you want to predict how that will come out?
I'm not making any predictions. But I'll say that's another example of a race that's been completely nationalized. In the next couple of days, we're going to have Vice President Biden in, you know, campaigning on behalf of Keating, and we have Romney, you know, Mitt Romney and Scott Brown, particularly Romney, who's a national figure, coming in to campaign on behalf of Perry. And you know, this is something that the little voters of Plymouth, you know, are almost overshadowed by the national attention on this race.
A little hard to tell what's going on there.
Simple as that, huh?
Yeah.
Barney Frank and Sean Bilod, they're running. Barney Frank, of course, 15-term incumbent. Sean Bilod is this 30-something Marine reservist from Brookline who's giving Barney Frank more of a run for his money than many people thought he would. The two of them were in our studio for an on-air debate earlier this week. And at one point, I had asked both of them how they planned to vote on question 3, which would slash the sales tax to 3%. Bilod said he plans to vote to reduce the tax, but that he thinks it probably won't pass, and that he thought that if it would pass, then he wouldn't vote for it. So let's listen to that exchange.
Voting has two purposes. One is to effect a change, and the other is obviously to also communicate a desire or a will among the people. For me, this is the latter. I think the polls show pretty clearly that it's not going to pass. And so I see this as a way of communicating that, yes, in Massachusetts, in order to stimulate the economy, we ultimately need lower taxes.
Barney Frank.
That is extraordinarily irresponsible. Mr. Bilod is trying to have it both ways. He says, I'm going to vote yes because I know it won't pass, because we're not making policy here. We're communicating. If Mr. Bilod wants to just be a communicator, he ought to switch jobs with you.
So I wonder what the two of you make of that. Bilod basically said, I'm going to vote on principle. What do you make of that?
I think it is double talk, and I think it's a kind of double talk that turns voters off, you know, that say where you stand and people will deal with it. But when you're on both sides of the issue, as John Kerry learned, it's very damaging. And it reduces civic engagement and creates and increases cynicism about politics and government.
Renee Law.
Yeah, I would just say this is an example of what's wrong with trying to make complicated policy, tax policy and law by the ballot. You know, what are you doing? Are you sending a message? No, you're creating a law. You're actually passing a law by the ballot. And I think this is just another example of why the initiative petition process is not the right instrument for complex fiscal policy.
Very quickly, before we move on to our hubbub week of the news, Karen Pulido, who's running for state treasurer, the Globe did a story within the past week saying that most of the vanity Red Sox plates have gone to Pulido friends and family members, that she played a role in passing that legislation. And I wonder whether, to you, that should matter to voters when they decide who to vote for.
Well, I think, you know, it's not a gigantic scandal, but I think particularly because Karen Pulido is presenting herself as a fresh face, a clean sweep, and somebody who's not going to be playing the same old political, crony games, that this is an example of, you know, some 68 license plates that went to her cronies. So, I mean, she has a little explaining to do.
Ken Cooper, briefly.
It smacks of, you know, Beacon Hill favoritism. I guess they said they passed out the plates first come, first serve. Looked like there were two lists, one for Pulido and her friends, and they went first come, first serve, and a list for everybody else that followed the same order.
So for our hubbub, which is a story of the week you think deserves mentioning, we have to be brief, maybe in 20, 25 seconds. Renee, what is the story that stood out to you?
Well, it's just my favorite moment from the debate, which now seems so long ago, that happened on Monday, where the candidates were asked what they thought the most important human virtue was. And Tim Cahill said loyalty, and you can see why, because of, you know, the betrayal that he endured in his candidacy. And then they went around to ask the different candidates what they thought the most overrated human virtue was, and Charlie Baker said loyalty.
Interesting contrast. Ken Cooper?
Yeah, mine is also on politics, a little narrower. In Roxbury and Dorchester, the 5th Suffolk race, state rep race, Carlos Enriquez, who's a 30-something community organizer, won by 41 votes in the candidate of 4 in the primary. And the runner-up, who's a baby boomer named Barry Lawton, has decided to run his sticker campaign. So it's an interesting intergenerational fight in the African-American community where, quite frankly, elected officials are older than they are elsewhere.
Mm. I want to mention something, actually two things that have to do with the music scene. One is that Harper's Ferry, this longtime music club in Alston, Brighton, is closing, although it's going to become another club by another name. And then related to that, this music promoter who was known in the Boston area for decades, Billy Ruane, he's the guy that basically brought live music to the Middle East. He died as well. The Globe had this great obit that said, "The life force that is music coursed through Billy Ruane as he danced to band after band and club after club, shirt unbuttoned to nearly his navel, swept back hair tussled by the beat." I thought it was a great line. So that's the music scene. Thank you very much to both of you. Ken Cooper is an independent journalist. Renee Loth is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. In just a minute, we'll pay a visit to an unusual dining experience where the diners are, ready for this, blindfolded. We'll be back shortly. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.